You are listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Why do some people seem to win at everything while others can't even catch a lucky break? Why do most of us care so much about winning? And does winning have any downsides? Ian H. Robertson looks at the latest brain research to answer these and many other questions in his latest book, The Winner Effect. Dr. Robertson is a professor of psychology at Trinity College, Dublin, and was a founding member of that college's Institute of Neuroscience. His book is published by Thomas Dunn Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Good morning.
You've said that winning is the factor that shapes our lives more completely than anything else. Well, there's a saying, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. But does everyone care about winning on some deep level, even if they say that winning doesn't matter to them?
Everyone cares about winning, but there are different types of winning. You can win for and be motivated to win for virtuous reasons, or you can be motivated to win for venal reasons, and different types of winning have different effects on you. So, yeah, no, winning is not in itself necessarily always good, but it's a primary motivation in almost all of us.
Well, when someone chooses to become a monk and takes a vow of silence and lives in a Buddhist monastery, do they see that as a winning position?
No, in the sense that winning usually implies or almost implies competition with other people. And so by definition, you cannot be a winner against other people when it's a spiritual journey. But there's always an aspect of winning as well, that's winning against yourself or achieving your own goals, if you like. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes can be the most authentic part of winning. And for any spiritual journey or for the monk you're talking about, will have to be really having a bit of a contest with himself, I guess.
And then there are some people who choose to be competitive in one area and not another. Like, I don't like to play competitive games. I don't like to play poker and gave a bridge when I was 20 years old because they or Scrabble. They just don't really appeal to me. On the other hand, I can't say that I'm not competitive.
Yeah, well, poker's pretty competitive, as I can tell you to my cost and having lost some money in the odd poker game. We differ in how competitive we are. There's different types of competition. We can be competitive to have power, or we can be competitive to have achievement, or we can be competitive to have affiliation, to have the admiration of others. These are three different types of motivation, if you like.
So is the degree to which individuals care about winning dependent on circumstances, such as where they live, the traits they've inherited and such?
Yes, I've been very struck. I've been reading Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson recently, and that's a fascinating tale of a man whose father went from great wealth to having lost it very rapidly. And Johnson was scarred by that feeling of humiliation, and as a result of the whole life he was terrified of humiliation. And from a very early age he wanted to be president. Yet when it came to the 1960 election, he refused to campaign and ended up being vice president to President Kennedy. And he was a man so driven to achieve, but who had great ambivalent attitudes towards it. And that, I think, went way back to being scarred by that early experience of his family's poverty.
Well, it's common knowledge that having an extremely wealthy or successful parent is no guarantee of success. Do you think that it makes it more difficult for some children of successful and famous people?
I think it does for many of them, not inevitably and not for all. But the problem is success can go to your head, literally. Success can change your brain. It increases testosterone, which increases a chemical messenger in the brain called dopamine, which alters your brain function to make you much more focused on goals and on achieving rewards. It makes you less empathic and more likely to treat others as objects. And so this can be a problem for highly successful people, can become very egotistical for these reasons. And egotistical people don't like to think that their success is happening for reasons other than their own greatness.
In fact, there's a new book that suggests that many of the newly rich in America have little empathy for the people they grew up with. They feel that they have been the deserving victors in a ruthless meritocracy. This is a kind of a self-justification from birth. Is that the kind of thinking that comes out of, let's bring in some of the scientific work here, the anterior cingulate cortex?
Well, the anterior cingulate cortex is a critical kind of decision-making process, and one of the mechanism in the brain, and one of its functions is to sort out dissonance in the brain. By dissonance, I mean discrepancies between what you think and believe and what you do. And it seems to be that a particular part of the anterior cingulate is critically involved in correcting our behavior or correcting our beliefs in order to make them consistent. The brain hates inconsistency. So, for instance, if you find yourself behaving selfishly vis-a-vis other people, then you are more inclined to come to believe that these people are deserving of that selfish behavior because you are virtuous and they are not.
This is kind of Calvinism. Calvinism of the brain, isn't it?
It is. Of course, the paradox of Calvinism is that you're predestined.
Yeah. Well, God has said that you should succeed, and you are the righteous one.
Well, that's right. And in my book, I talk about the curse of genetic fatalism, where people are cursed with the belief that their intelligence or their abilities or their personality are inherited, and there's nothing they can do about them. And people who believe these things, if they don't hit any problems in life, can do very well indeed. But that's not that common. And children who believe their intelligence is endowed, if they're faced with a difficult problem, they're much more likely to give up. And children who believe that their personality is endowed rather than something they can work at, if they get a rejection at school, they're more likely to withdraw and suffer further isolation. So an entity, as you say, Calvinistic view of your abilities can be handicapping.
It's part of the reason we all want to win, at least on some level, that winning is so closely connected to power.
Yes, power is one of the fundamental motivations. I only discovered about power myself personally when for about 3 years I was promoted to a pro vice chancellor job in the university where I work in Dublin. And it occurred to me in doing this job where I had a lot of power that I didn't particularly enjoy power. It didn't do anything for me. But I saw other colleagues who got off on power. They enjoyed it. And that's why I started exploring this research and then eventually writing this book. Because power is one of the three main motivations the humans have, and not all of us have that same desire for power. But we need people in the world who have a desire for power. The last thing we need is leaders who have no appetite for power. And one of the problems I felt with the presidential debate, 10 days ago, was President Obama looked as if he didn't want power. I know that was a superficial appearance, but he didn't have the perceptual trappings of power for other people. So we need people who appear hungry for power, but it has to be a healthy appetite.
You've written that winning and the power that comes with it can reshape the brain to make people smarter, more ambitious, more aggressive, and more focused.
Yes. So power actually changes your chemistry of your brain, particularly the frontal lobes of your brain. They change your attention to make you more focused on goals and on rewards. And they downplay your the kind of more anxious, vigilant part of your brain that looks for risks and the downside of things. So the power that financial bankers and financial traders had before 2008 really did skew their thinking and led them to make judgments that were poor. But on the positive side, some people, given power, become capable of thinking more strategically and more abstractly. They become more decisive. They become more positive and optimistic.
What about testosterone in all of this?
Yeah.
Does it increase with power?
Yeah, in both men and women, power increases testosterone, a hormone that makes you increases sexual activity, increases aggression, increases motivation, and alters cognitive function as well.
So testosterone has been shown to swell the brain's motivation circuits.
Yeah.
And then increase a person's will to fight. Could we give people testosterone injections to help them succeed?
Well, people do get testosterone injections.
Well, athletes do.
Yes. I mean, we saw what happened with Lance Armstrong, who took testosterone, and that was a factor in his success, and that was very widespread in cycling, I believe. So that's one reason why it works, but it's much healthier to generate it naturally.
You may think that you understand why you're driven to win, but Ian Robertson has shown how complicated it all is. We're happy to have him here today to discuss his new book called The Winner Effect from St. Martin's Press. You have pointed to Mike Tyson's experience returning to the boxing ring after he'd been released from prison as an example of how the winning effect works.
Yes, and long before scientists discovered the winner effect in the wake of the Second World War, boxing promoters knew about it. Because if they had a prospective champion, before they would set that boxer up to the real fight against the real competitor, they would set up fights against what they call tomato cans, which are weakened or older or not so good opponents, where they were doomed to be beaten by the prospective champ. But the mere act of winning actually makes it more likely that you will win the final big fight. That's what the winner effect is. And these changes happen. The act of winning physically restructures your brain so that your brain becomes more sensitive to testosterone's effects.
So you go in to the fight with the feeling that you can win and belief in yourself. If you have a lot of self-doubt, you're less likely to win?
Yes, but it's not just about self-doubt and it's not just about beliefs. Yes, these things are true. But what happens, well, we know this in animals and we assume it happens in humans. When you win, the increase in testosterone actually increases the number of receptors in your brain in key aggression and motivation areas for testosterone, so that when you have another contest, even a month later, the surge of testosterone that will arise because of the contest will have a bigger effect on your brain because there are more receptors for it. This is true for chess players as much as boxers, by the way.
Well, I can understand how testosterone will play a role, but can you tell us about a British study that looked at boxers randomly assigned to wear red or blue shorts during their matches?
This is a very well-established study in the Olympic Games, but also in soccer. So in certain sports in the Olympics, like Greco-Roman wrestling and boxing, competitors are randomly allocated to blue and red shirts. And statistically, you're significantly more likely to win if you get the red shirt than if you get the blue shirt. The same is true for soccer teams across the world. If they're wearing their non-preferred strip, all soccer teams have a strip they have to wear if it's too like the other team. If they're wearing a non-preferred strip that is red, they're more likely to win against the other team.
So if one of the debaters tonight wants to win, it's better not to wear a blue shirt or it's better to wear a red tie?
I felt that President Obama 10 days ago suffered by virtue of wearing the blue tie against Governor Romney's red tie. I felt it on its own, it wouldn't necessarily make a difference, but the combination of his averted eyes and his bowed head as he looked down at his notes and the blue tie gave the impression of dominance by Governor Romney against President Obama.
How long does the winning effect last? And are they the same in women as they are in men?
Women have similar response, similar testosterone increases to winning as do men. We only know that they last for sure for weeks, but it's very likely they last for months and even years. But one difference between men and women is this. Your motivation to have power can be for either selfish reasons or for social reasons, the good of others. So teachers and nurses, for instance, have quite a high motivation for power, but it's power to influence people by doing a good, if you like, for a community or a group of people. People who are selfishly, egotistically motivated for power have a different biological response to getting, to winning, than do people with a more social motivation. There are plenty of men with a social motivation as well, but they get less of a testosterone high and less of a prolonged testosterone high to winning.
Well, people who do not have a lot of money often wonder why the multi-billionaires are driven to do everything possible to get more money. Is this all part of the way their brain chemistry is working?
Yes. So when you get a pay rise, Leonard, or when someone pays...
If you ever get a pay rise.
Or if I get paid a compliment, or if I have sex, or if I take alcohol, there's a common pathway in the middle of my brain called the reward network, which activates with this chemical messenger called dopamine. And power is a very powerful activator of that as well.
Well, we're going to take a little break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about dopamine and some of the other things that you write about in this book called The Winner Effect, written by Ian Robertson, who is a professor of psychology at Trinity College Dublin and a founding member of that college's Institute of Neuroscience. The Winner Effect, The Neuroscience of Success and Failure, is published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. Stay with us for more. We are back with Dr. Ian Robertson, his book, The Winner Effect, which is published by Thomas Dunn, imprint of St. Martin's Press. Professor Robertson is a professor of psychology at Trinity College Dublin, also a founding member of that college's Institute of Neuroscience. And before we get to dopamine, a listener wants to know if women experience the surge of testosterone in the same way that men do.
Yes, the answer is very similarly. Women have lower base rates of testosterone than men quite considerably, but if they're in competitions, they show similar increases in testosterone and seem to respond to winning in a similar way to men. That being said, women on average have a little more of less egotistical motivation for power than men do, so they're slightly protected against the kind of potentially addictive effects of power, which is why we need more women on boards.
So the addictive effects are psychological, or are they chemical? Is it we like that surge of testosterone?
Well, I would venture to say that they're a combination of psychological and physical addiction, because power powerfully affects the same reward network in the brain that cocaine does.
And we're talking about dopamine. We want to add that to this.
Yes. So testosterone increases dopamine, and dopamine is the main kind of fuel of the brain's reward network, which is the common feel-good network of the brain.
It's the neurotransmitter that controls the brain's reward and pleasure centers. So it's released when we're winning?
When we're winning, yes. So if you set up a contest between two people and one person wins, you will get an increase in testosterone, and you will get, more importantly, perhaps, you get a decrease in cortisol, which is a stress hormone. And this may play a part in the lengthened lives of winners.
But is this also why people, gamblers, for example, sometimes gamble the house, even though it can lead to major disaster?
You know, I've worked as a clinical psychologist in the past, and some of the most severe addictions I've ever seen have been gambling addictions. They're indistinguishable from heroin addiction, from alcohol addiction, when they get to a severe state. And it's because they hijack the same reward system in the brain that things like cocaine and alcohol can do.
You've suggested it's useful to think of our need for dopamine in terms of the Goldilocks principle. What's the Goldilocks principle?
So Goldilocks didn't like her porridge too cold or too hot. She didn't like her beds too soft or too hard. There was an optimal level, which was just right. And the brain's a bit like that for several of its key chemical messengers, and dopamine being one. And so if you get a reward or a compliment or have sex, you get an increase in dopamine, and that can make you change you in many ways. If you get too much for too long and it's unconstrained, that can really unbalance your judgment.
Do people who have lived through deprivation when they were young, are they more likely to compensate later by being more aggressive?
They're not like necessarily going to be more aggressive, but if given power, there's maybe a slightly bigger risk that they will abuse that power.
On the other hand, if you've had a good job and suddenly you find yourself unemployed and the bills are piling up, should I assume the dopamine levels really start dropping?
Yes, the answer is yes.
We see people who are like beached whales after they lose a job. They become listless. They just lie around on the couch and watch television.
Well, that's right. And if we expect to get a reward and we don't get it, the reverse happens to when we get a reward. We get a drop of dopamine. And the reward center is also the pain center of the brain. So that's it feels like pain to lose status like that and to lose reward.
Could a dopamine addiction be an explanation for why leaders like Hosni Mubarak and Muammar Gaddafi were unwilling to relinquish power, even when it was obvious that their position was hopeless in the long run?
My view is yes, that if you have unfettered power, it will push the brain's dopamine levels out of the Goldilocks zone into the excess area, where you get extreme loss of empathy, extreme tendency to treat others as objects, and extreme egotism, which is an appetite that can never be properly satisfied.
So it's unfortunate that we weren't able to test Stalin or Hitler or Mao or Kim Il-sung or Idi Amin or Pol Pot for whether they had too high levels of dopamine.
No, but perhaps we can make a guess that they might have had by the fact that almost all of them made terrible judgments in the end. Hitler invading Russia and following in Napoleon's footsteps in a catastrophic decision. Power does, in extreme levels, corrupt judgment.
The Cultural Revolution for Mao, for example.
Yes, and he starved to death, 20, 30 million people in the Great Leap Forward, yes.
You've said dopamine dysregulation may have been responsible for the changes that were seen in someone like Jeff Skilling at Enron.
Yes, he was a very interesting character because at college he was a very clever man, but he wasn't seen as being any special kind of personality. He was seen as an easygoing guy. Yet once he became CEO of Enron, he behaved in extraordinary ways, like, the employees would be waiting to drive into the car park, and he would drive on the wrong side of the road, overtaking them all, giving the middle finger to them as he went. And he seemed to really, along with a small other group of Enron leaders, seemed to really suffer a loss of judgment and a huge inability to see risk.
You've said that one of the questions you hope to answer in this book was whether success had somehow impaired the judgments of the CEOs of the big three American automakers, who saw nothing wrong with flying to Washington in their personal corporate jets in 2008 to beg for bailout money.
Well, that's right. That was extraordinary. And the press corps who were waiting in Washington were open-mouthed because here they were coming begging. Otherwise, their industries would have completely failed, and yet they flew in corporate jets. And what I talk about in the book is that the extent to which the power that they had blinded them to the perspectives of other people, how other people would see that.
Well, we've talked a lot over the years about the studies which showed that anyone given the power over somebody else could be coerced into abusing that power.
That is a real risk. Not everyone will succumb to it, but it is a huge temptation, and it's made easier by the fact that power tends to make you lose empathy and see other people as objects, and so it becomes easier to treat people badly and less able to for you to feel their pain.
A German study showed that senior executives who had power began over time to see their underlings more as objects or means to an end than in terms of their personal qualities.
That's right. And that's true of their friendships as well. People who develop a lot of power, there's a tendency for them to start seeing people as how useful they are to them rather than as individuals. And this is it's a fundamental problem. The more unequal a society is, the more power you have concentrated in a relatively small number of hands, and that can be a real problem in sorting out social inequalities.
How much is money a motivating factor in people's desire to win?
Well, some researchers have made a very good and strong argument that money has very powerful drug-like qualities that are not unlike those of drugs like cocaine. Money is a hugely powerful reinforcer, and we feel good when we get money because of the increase of dopamine in the midbrain of our brain.
But don't people work as much for the satisfaction of a job well done and for the approval of a boss or colleagues as they do for the money?
Oh, absolutely, and the people who are happiest in jobs are ones who are motivated by that, what we call authentic desires for success as opposed to the external, extrinsic ones of money.
My guest is Professor Ian H. Robertson. His book, The Winner Effect, The Neuroscience of Success and Failure. Is Henry Kissinger the only person to have called power an aphrodisiac?
Well, he may be the only person to have put it into words, but certainly it is astonishing the amount of sexual activity in powerful people. I even went on Saturday, I went to the opening of Hyde Park on the Hudson, the film by Roosevelt, and he had several affairs. John F. Kennedy had several affairs. In general, both men and women who have a lot of power have more sexual activity.
In fact, we see this among politicians, even when it goes against everything that they say about their ideology, because they just can't help themselves? Well, or they see it that way?
Well, power is sexually arousing both for the person who holds the power and for other people of the opposite sex who are attracted to that person's power. They want a bit of that action.
A listener wonders, do success and power evolve into happiness or a sense of accomplishment or self-realization? You seem to be suggesting that at times it's counterproductive.
Well, it can be counterproductive if it's for inauthentic reasons. If I want to win all the time, and if my motivation is to be first, I'm really probably doomed to be unhappy because there's always someone better than me. If, however, my motivation is to win against goals I've set myself, preferably goals that have some benefit beyond just my own self, then that will tend to make me happy if I succeed in these.
Does the amount of dopamine an individual's brain gets from winning depend on whether they expected to win or were surprised by their victory?
Yes. So the dopamine system works as a kind of signaling system where once we get used to expecting a given level of reward, for instance, you know, my job, I get my paycheck every month. My paycheck doesn't cause a big surge in dopamine. It did maybe the first time I got it. But if I get a pay rise, the dopamine signals to that change and gives a big signal. Similarly, if one month I get less money, my dopamine plummets, and that's like pain. So the dopamine system, that's one reason why greed happens, is because once you get into a system of looking for more, then you can never be satisfied. It's like a drug addiction, which can never be satisfied except by upping the doses.
You have an anecdote in here about several patients who hadn't had a history of gambling problems until they were prescribed the drugs Rapinirole and Pramipexole. Is that how
yes.
you pronounce them?
Yes.
That was for restless leg syndrome
yes.
and Parkinson's disease, and then they became compulsive gamblers.
Yes. So this doesn't happen, let me reassure the listeners, to only a tiny percentage of people who are given these
drugs. I can't
drugs.
Wait to hear this in the commercial.
But these were cases reported from the Mayo Clinic in public journals of anonymous cases who had been given for, one of them for restless leg syndrome was given one of these drugs which acts on the dopamine system. And indeed, this person who didn't have a history of gambling at all ended up squandering many tens of thousands of dollars on gambling.
But you also said earlier that one of the reasons most people like women winning and the power that comes with it is that it can reduce the amount of stress that we're likely to experience.
Yes, and one of the most sobering facts is that the higher your status, the longer you will live. So Nobel Prize winners live on average 4 years longer than Nobel Prize nominees.
And what does the Oscar also prolong life?
Sorry, I meant the Oscar, but the Nobel Prize is about a year and a half length and compared to nominees. And it's very likely that it's the cortisol-reducing effects of achieving that permanent badge of your virtue and taking you out the rat race to a certain extent that protects your body from the ravages of cortisol. That's a reasonable hypothesis to explain that.
Well, okay, so if you win an Oscar, you live longer than if you win a Nobel Prize. In fact, stars who won two or more Oscars were shown to live an average of 6 years longer than the ones who were nominated, which is a great honor in itself, but didn't win. Now, is it the Nobel Prize isn't as good to win as an Oscar, or is it because those people are already so used to getting a lot of accolades that the Nobel doesn't give them the kind of boost that an Oscar might give an actor?
Well, let me just say that the lengthening the life of a Nobel Prize winner by a year and a half is an enormous, enormous achievement. It's even more mind-boggling that it's 4 years for Nobel Prize winners. I wouldn't like to compare the two because the samples are so different and the ages are different. So I wouldn't like. What I would say is that achieving a great status, like winning an Olympic gold medal or achieving an Oscar, is it takes the pressure off the threat to the self, and probably means you don't have to keep proving yourself. And that is a huge protector against the ravages of cortisol, which is a stress hormone.
Now, you mentioned earlier that when you became the head of a department, you didn't enjoy the power as much as some other people. But I'm assuming that when you write a book, you're hoping that it becomes a bestseller.
Yes.
And you make a lot of money. So isn't that pretty much the same process?
Well, power is defined as having control over resources that other people want or need. My motivation for writing the book is much more about achievement, and that's a separate motivation. So I've got a very high achievement motivation, but not a huge power motivation, and these are two different types of motivation.
Well, in the end, money becomes the thing that is true of both of them.
Yes, but I wouldn't write a book just for the sake of the money. I only want to write a book that other people find interesting, so I'm not primarily motivated by the money.
At least one critic has compared your book to the work of Malcolm Gladwell. You must have been aware of that while you were working on it.
I unashamedly pay tribute to Malcolm Gladwell for having pioneered a wonderful style of writing that I've tried to develop myself.
Which is looking at a lot of different studies and trying to figure out how they all fit into some general theory?
Yes, it is that, but it's also about trying to come up with real-life stories. With real stories, and trying to make the science digestible and interesting by interweaving them in the stories. And what people must be careful not doing is thinking that the stories are evidence, the stories are examples.
Now, a listener asks whether controlling and power-mad individuals are born psychopaths, because that's the way they're often portrayed.
Well, I don't think that necessarily psychopaths, most leaders who become obviously corrupted by power start off psychopaths. There might be a few like that, but actually psychopaths have difficulty. Frank psychopaths don't do well in life because their judgments of other people are so skewed and so totally selfish, and they're more likely to end in prison than they are to end up in power. I think that extreme power can make psychopaths of people, though, if it's unfettered.
A listener wonders whether you recommend someone going through a difficult time might want to get testosterone injections.
I wouldn't recommend that.
What about dopamine?
Well, dopamine, the healthiest way to get dopamine would be to succeed, to get small successes. And that could be in sport, that could be in the gym, that could be running, that could be interacting with other people. These are the healthy ways. The risk, if you artificially interfere with dopamine, the risk is you become dependent on it. That's what cocaine and heroin do.
And there are these receptors. The reason we even understood that we had the body creates its own opiates is because the receptors were already there.
Exactly. And just these drugs are very clever at hijacking these natural systems.
Ian Robertson will be reading and signing books at the Columbia Books Shop on Wednesday, November 7th at 6 o'clock. That's about 117th Street and Broadway. His book, The Winner Effect, The Neuroscience of Success and Failure, published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Leonard.